morning to you. Let's give everybody a second to get in and out of the courtroom. Which appears to have now taken place, so you may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Justices. Good to see all of you again. My name is Marty Klein. I'm with Attorney Law, D.C. in North Fork, Nebraska. I'm here representing Leonardo Alarcon Chavez. This is a post-conviction appeal out of Madison County. The Honorable Mark Johnson presided over that matter. This particular case, the post-conviction motion was filed, and evidentiary hearing is held on all of the issues from the motion for evidentiary hearing in this particular case. Judge Johnson ultimately ruled that the motion for post-conviction relief was denied on all grounds. One of the biggest issues that we have in this particular case deals with the ineffective assistance of counsel, and specifically whether or not counsel advised the element of a particular matter of some of the constitutional and statutory rights that he had. In particular, voir dire was not recorded. Obviously, under the court rules, if requested by any party, the voir dire proceeding must be recorded along with the opening and closing statements. Chavez testified during the post-conviction hearing that he was not advised of that right. And further, on examination by Todd Lancaster, the trial counsel, in the matter,
What is the constitutional issue for not being advised that you can take? You can have a court reporter take down for dire questioning?
I think the issue, Justice, comes down to the fact that we don't know what happened during voir dire. We know that we had a citizen or a person of Cuban descent filed for murder. There were three Hispanic jurors originally paneled in Madison County on that trial. We don't know what happened, what questions were asked, why some of them were struck, and ultimately we know which one that was struck by the state. There was a Batson type of challenge that was brought up by the state, and they explained why they had struck one of the jurors. But we don't know what happened during the rest of voir dire, what questions were asked, and anything else.
Who struck the other two people you just talked about?
One was struck for cause before another person was impaneled, and the other one was struck by the trial counsel.
And don't we know a little bit about the reasoning because of Mr. Lancaster's testimony and the prosecutor's testimony?
Yes, we do, because that is the only portion of court here, so to speak, that was. We went through the reason for the state's strike.
Didn't Mr. Lancaster testify that in his trial strategy it was beneficial for Mr. Alarcon Chavez to have these two individuals stricken?
Yeah.
Okay. So how was he prejudiced then by that?
Well, I guess the issue is we don't know what happened during the rest of the voir dire. I mean, there's no record before us. We don't have any information if there were any other errors or if there were not. So I guess as I stand before you, I don't know.
That sort of sounds like the classic definition of a fishing expedition.
Well, that is probably.
Okay.
I disagree with that. But I think the fact that voir dire wasn't reported has to go along with the other issues that we're dealing with the ineffective assistance. For example, it was questionable about whether or not there was a plea offer. Obviously, the appellant during the post-conviction hearings was, and it was not communicated to him in a timely manner. Also, there was an issue of whether or not there were four witnesses that the appellant brought forth for his trial counsel to speak with. His trial counsel only spoke with one of them. In this particular case, we're dealing with a murder trial. There are four witnesses that the appellant brought forth to his counsel that he would like to testify on his behalf. It was very questionable about whether or not those witnesses were contacted in a timely manner. As such, only one of the witnesses was actually contacted. Again,
were these character witnesses?
They would have been not only character witnesses, but one of the witnesses, the appellant testified at the post-conviction hearing, would have established that the victim had threatened the appellant at one point in time. Another one of the witnesses allegedly would have testified that the victim had very aggressive behavior. This would have went toward the self-defense argument the appellant was arguing at trial. A couple of other things. I don't know if the independent testing of the DNA would have made any difference in this particular matter, because we were dealing with a self-defense argument at trial. However, the appellant in this matter was never advised of his right to have that done, nor did Mr. Lancaster say if he can recall whether or not he was ever told of that right.
If it wouldn't have made any difference, how could that possibly result in any prejudice?
On that particular issue, it would not. Okay. I guess I'm looking at everything cumulatively. Sorry, does that answer?
It does, thank you.
Okay, sorry. The other thing is whether or not the state's witnesses could have been deposed. Again, Mr. Chavez was not advised of this right, did not know that that could have happened. Another issue that we have here deals with the interpreters. Under the Nebraska statutes, interpreters must, under Nebraska Revised Statute 25-2401, interpreters must be available to assist such persons in removal proceedings. Again, in this particular matter, there's an issue of whether or not the appellant had the ability to understand what was going on at trial due to the fact that he had a problem understanding one of the interpreters in this particular matter.
What was the post-conviction court's factual findings with respect to that issue after the evidentiary hearing?
After the evidentiary hearing, they ultimately, one of the issues that came up specifically during the evidentiary hearing, Mr. Chavez said, during the noon break, during the first day of trial, he had gone to his counsel, and he thought that there was a sidebar with the judge. We actually went through, we reviewed the tapes. There wasn't any conversation that we could find. The reporter shut the tape off or not. In any event, there was no formal proceeding, any discussion between the judge, trial counsel, as to whether or not or could understand the proceedings based upon the one interpreter that he did. Sorry, I don't think I have any question.
Did the post-conviction judge make factual findings that were consistent with the testimony of defense counsel and the interpreter who
yes.
testified at the evidentiary hearing?
Yes.
So in other words, the credibility of those witnesses was accepted by the post-conviction court?
It was, yes.
Is your focus about a deficiency that with respect to the interpreter's abilities, or the defendant is unable to understand the interpretation?
Yeah, it was more with the way that the interpreter spoke. He just couldn't hear what the interpreter was saying for life, as opposed to not understanding what the interpreter was.
Because of a physical limitation?
Yes. Yes.
Thank you.
Is that particular claim, the claim with respect to the court interpreter, procedurally barred? Is it a claim that could have been raised on direct appeal?
Yes.
Was it raised on direct appeal?
It was not. He did have the same counsel on direct appeal as he did.
But you're not presenting it in the wrapped up as an ineffective assistance of counsel claim?
No. No, okay. Because this is a separate claim. Whether or not he could understand the issue. Sidebar with the judge at any point. Well, obviously there's no record.
Thank you.
There's no other questions to anyone. Thank you, Justice.
Thank you very much. Ms. Klein, good morning to you.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Mr. Chief Justice. I'm Kimberly Klein, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state in this matter. As I think the most significant issue raised here is the Batson issue, which sort of interplays with the voir dire claim. Essentially, as I understand what his claim is that he was denied a Batson challenge because voir dire wasn't recorded. But the testimony at the post-conviction hearing made clear that there was no Batson challenge made, because the witness over whom the Batson kerfuffle is being made was one that would have been struck by defense counsel had the state not done it for him, essentially. The state had reasons for striking him. They said this particular prospective juror showed up late both days to voir dire, and he wasn't very impressed with that. And Mr. Lancaster said that this particular prospective juror was a criminal justice major, and said it would be an honor to serve on the jury, which Lancaster interpreted as the words of someone who would be essentially looking to convict his client. So he wanted him gone. The state wanted him gone. Even had a Batson challenge been made, which Lancaster said he had absolutely no intention of making, there would have been perfectly justifiable reasons for striking this particular prospective juror. Your Honors, if you have, there are quite a few other issues raised. If you have particular questions, I would be happy to answer them. Otherwise, I think we have adequately addressed the issues in our brief. And if there are
none. I had a question as to how you understand the challenge with respect to the interpreter.
Well, he's kind of changed his... The defendant has made several different claims that sort of mutate as the whole thing went along. It started out that his first claim was that he couldn't understand the guy because the defendant speaks Cuban Spanish, and the guy, Kelly Murph, the interpreter, apparently speaks some other variety of Spanish, and the defendant was claiming he couldn't understand the two of them. Well, Murph's testimony said, look, I spoke with the defendant in Spanish. I had no problem understanding him. I can't see why he would have problems understanding me. He never told me he had problems understanding me. He never raised the issue of not being able to understand me. So whatever the issue was, apparently it was late raised. It was never raised to the district court at any point in time. He apparently mentioned too.
Does the record indicate that the interpreter actually asked the defendant if he understood the interpreter?
Yes. In Murph's deposition, he said, I asked him if you're having any problems understanding me, and he told me he wasn't. So I didn't see any reason to pursue the subject further. So I think the district court made specific findings along those particular lines, and I don't think that the record shows that those are clearly erroneous. If there are no further questions, we would ask that the denial of post-conviction relief be affirmed. Thank you.
Before you sit down, do you believe that the claims with respect to the interpreter are procedurally barred?
I think they probably are. Well, since he had the same counsel on direct appeal as he had at trial, they probably could have been raised, but had they been raised in the guise of an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, I would probably have to answer that differently, but since they're being raised essentially as an independent claim, I think they are procedurally. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
1 minute.
1 minute and 8 seconds, Mr. Klein.
Well, I would just come up and see if anyone had any further questions based on Ms. Klein's statements for today.
Thank you very much. Were you appointed in this matter, Mr. Klein?
I'm sorry.
Were you appointed in this matter?
Yes, I was.
Thank you for your service. We will go on to the next case of the day.